episode 39 of the Mental Dive podcast, where we talk anything and everything sports psychology and mental performance. I'm your host, Taylor Staden. Let's talk about comfort zones for a second. So the whole idea of a comfort zone, obviously, as it's, you know, implied with the name, is it's kind of this bubble, you know, we have psychological bubble where everything we're comfortable with and everything we know and everything we're confident in ourselves doing is basically enclosed in this bubble. And sometimes a comfort zone can be a good thing. Sometimes we want to be able to just chill for a bit and just feel safe, you know? And that's when the comfort zone is useful. But the problem with the comfort zone is that when we become too entrenched in the comfort zone, we tend to become very complacent, which limits our growth, limits our potential for, you know, a sense of self-fulfillment, and ultimately just limits our potential. So you always hear, you know, your coach or your teacher or your mentors or whoever say, yeah, like, you got to go outside your comfort zone. And that can be really scary. But I think it's just about developing a new kind of relationship with your comfort zone and understanding that if you want to get better, then the comfort zone can help you do that. But you're going to feel obviously uncomfortable when you're outside of it. So if anybody is looking to go outside of their comfort zone, I think it's just important to just take a small step. Just dip your toe, you know, outside of the comfort zone. Because if you do too much too soon, it's going to be very overwhelming and you're going to have a negative experience probably. It's going to be like, it's too much. But if you just work on these small marginal gains and just do little things and build on them and build on them, then it can become a lot less daunting. And we'll begin to develop that better relationship with our comfort zone. And so for me, for example, with comfort zones, is this upcoming Friday, I'll actually be moving to a new country, which is crazy to think about when I say it out loud. But I'll be moving to Greece next Friday for a couple months to start, because I will be beginning a Master's of Science program at the University of Thessaly in sport and exercise psychology. And I get the question from, you know, people I'm close with, and, you know, when someone hears I'm going to Greece to study a master's, they ask, why? You know, why are you going all the way to Europe? I mean, there's a ton of reasons why I'd want to go to Europe. You know, the weather's gorgeous. You get to learn a lot more about culture, and the program itself is really unique. Something that really drew me in. But ultimately for me, I really want to challenge myself to go outside of my comfort zone. Because if I want to be able to talk to athletes about the benefits of going outside of the comfort zone and all the potential opportunities and growth, you know, that come with going outside of your comfort zone, I want to be able to relate. And so what better way to do that than to travel to a country that you don't know a whole lot about and get to meet so many new people and have all these new opportunities. So I'm very, very grateful for everyone that's helped me get to this point. And I, for one, cannot wait to start. So today's episode, today's interview rather, is with Lindsay Hamilton. So Lindsay is an incredible person. I actually had the opportunity to meet Lindsay back at the ASP conference in Toronto in 2018. And one thing that really struck me about Lindsay and what I remember so fondly is she was just so kind. Like, you know, me being just, you know, undergraduate student, I went up to her and I introduced myself after a presentation by a former guest of the show, David DeSilva, as well as Sarah Castillo. And I was just talking to her and she had the biggest smile on her face. She was so welcoming, answering all my questions. So it kind of occurred to me recently. I was like, Lindsay would be an incredible person to have on the podcast. that, you know, Lindsay is the assistant head of mental conditioning at IMG Academy in Florida. And throughout the course of the podcast, me and Lindsay had a great discussion around applying mental skills to such a vast variety of sports at IMG. You know, they offer golf, soccer, basketball, you name it. Me and Lindsay also get into a discussion about integrating mental skills into the actual physical practices themselves, normalizing mental skills work, and developing that culture of mental skills being part of the process with the athletes at IMG, as well as confidence and comfort zones being one of her favorite discussions to talk about with athletes. So I'm really, really looking forward to sharing today's episode with you today. Further ado, Lindsay Hamilton, everybody. So Lindsay, thank you so much for joining me today. I really, really appreciate you taking the time to join the podcast. Like we've talked a bit before, it's been a couple of years now since we initially got to meet at Aspen, Toronto. So how have you been doing?
Oh, I have been doing well. Thank you so much for having me on the conversation today. I'm just delighted to be here. Things are going well for us down here at IMG Academy. We've been able to safely get back into working with the student athletes here on campus and in all facets. So grateful for everybody's health and the opportunity to continue to do fun work.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I guess this upcoming school year has probably put a lot of challenges into the mix as well, you know, with the COVID-19 and being in Florida. What are some maybe ways you're adapting with the students in that sense?
Yeah. So I think one of the things that are occurring is we have a lot smaller groups. We definitely have restrictions in terms of how we can interact with them, which has been such an incredible opportunity to really think creatively about how to deliver the mental skills training in and of themselves, you know, taking more initiative to be out on the field or court or course more as opposed to in an enclosed classroom, but then really all of the opportunity that brings up to be able to integrate mental skills into the live performance environment has been really cool. You know, some of the exercises that are activities or different ways in which we would try to bring some of those mental training experiences to life, we can't use simply because of sharing of equipment or different things like that. So again, another challenge to think outside of the box and find new ways to communicate and create experiences for those mental skills training opportunities. So, you know, oftentimes that's the way of it. You know, something changes and you end up finding new ways to do things that were contributing to what you were going for in the first place. So it's been exciting and certainly challenging, but, you know, I think to have seen the mental conditioning team thrive in how they've adapted to be able to continue to serve the student athletes has been really powerful.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And I'd imagine you're putting a lot of emphasis on the skill of being adaptable as well during these times with the student athletes.
Yes, we are. You know, there's a lot of conversation on adaptability. There's a lot of conversation on stress management and expectation management. And interestingly, one of the things that we're seeing, which doesn't, I mean, it's no surprise, but a lot of the student athletes that I will be working with moving forward really want to go back into confidence. And, you know, thinking about that, it doesn't surprise me. A lot of these student athletes have been away from the performance competitive context of their sport for 6 months at this point. And, you know, questioning, you know, are they in the right place? Are they going to be fit enough? Are they going to be able to compete when the games turn back on and all these kinds of things? So, you know, it's definitely been a common theme for the athletes that I've been working with that they want to spend time in that area as well.
Mm-hmm, for sure. So Lindsay, one way I really always like to start off the podcast is I'd love to get your story. You know, how you got involved in sports psychology and mental performance. What's your why? I was doing a little research before and I believe you were a soccer coach. So I'd imagine you played as well. I'd love to get your story and just how you got to where you are now.
Sure. You know, I don't have as much of a direct line as you might think of, you know, school and then grad school and then into the applied work. I got my bachelor's degree from Chapman University originally in psychology as well as sociology, and I was an athlete in college. I played soccer in college and was a coach, as you referenced, which has been such a privilege opportunity to coach at any level, really. And I can remember being a senior in college and as a psych major and somebody saying, Lindsay, you should do sports psychology. And my response with no hesitation was, I'll never do sports psychology. So here we are, flash forward, never say never, right? Because I'm in sports psychology now. But that really wasn't on my radar I don't know if it was because I felt like some of the experiences hit too close to home, you know, like injuries over the course of the time. And, you know, just you pour so much of yourself into your work as an athlete that I felt like maybe I was even ready to transition into a different phase of life, and ended up, you know, taking a job actually at Stanford University doing psychology research, which was a huge passion of mine. I love research. I had done research in undergrad, was able to have the privilege to go on and do psych research in the social psychology domain. And then, you know, responsibly quit my job in the middle of the 2009 recession and went traveling. So that took me in a completely different direction, came back and found myself in the automotive. So I spent a couple of years there, and, you know, that's when I really came to feel like I wasn't doing what my life's calling was, and was living in Utah at the time and stumbled across the University of Utah's master's program in sports psychology and thought, this is going to be great. I do love sport. I love psychology. You know, I'll go back to school and really go in the research line. And I love research. This is going to be awesome. So I went back to school. And I can remember in my first semester being in a class, and a student was doing this exercise where they were like trying to show how you can put athletes on a spectrum and get them to know more about each other. So in this demonstration, his spectrum was how applied you are and then how research oriented you are and where do you fall on in the line. And I was the only one that was 100% over in the research line. And my professor at the time, Dr. Nicole Detling, who is a dear friend and mentor of mine, was like, oh no, you're not. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, I love research. I'm going to do research. And she's like, oh no, you're not. And we had a lot of conversation, and she's, you know, encouraged me to explore the applied opportunities. And I ended up going both the applied track in our master's program, as well as the research thesis track, and, graduated with a job here at IMG Academy doing full-time applied work and haven't looked back since. And I, you know, really fell into the applied sports psychology work and have truly found what I'm called to do.
I love that. And sorry, I must intervene here. When you mentioned Dr. Detling, I don't read a lot of research, if I'm being honest, but I do remember reading an article of hers recently. I believe it was around resiliency. Is that something up her alley?
She does do a lot of resilience work, specifically in like the government sector. So yeah, she spends a lot of time working with corporations and organizations in addition to the athletes that she works with on resiliency, and particularly now during times of COVID, it's been and tremendously helpful.
Mm-hmm, for sure. You know, I find it pretty funny how you go from saying I would never do sports psychology to eventually being the assistant head of mental conditioning at IMG Academy. It's funny. I was speaking with Justin Schaefer the other day, MLB pitcher, and he told me something very similar, where when he was in college, the coach wanted to pitch, and he's like, no, last thing I want to do. And he ends up being drafted as a pitcher and pitch at the MLB level. So it's really funny to kind of look at and think about where you are today and how maybe your perspectives and your, you know, your values and everything has changed over time. So I love that. One thing I find really, really interesting about IMG Academy is that you offer so many different sports: baseball, tennis, soccer, basketball, the list goes on. What are some ways that perhaps you maybe cater mental skills development to various different groups? And what are some ways you think this is best done?
Yeah, so we do. We do have 8 sports here at the Academy. And in addition to all of the other sports or performers that come onto campus. And I think the first thing that I think about when really trying to understand how do you shape the mental skills work specifically for them is understanding the demands of their context. Because when we think about the skills, most of us are doing some form of self-talk or visualization or breathing or perspective shifting or any of those kinds of things. But really, it's how does that apply directly into their demand and the situations in which they're in. And that's really the first place to start, understanding that context. The other half of my job here at the Academy is actually translating this high performance mindset work into our corporate clients as well. Mm-hmm. And I find the same real demand applies, that I have to understand, well, what's their environment like? Because we all experience pressure, but where does pressure show up for them? How does it impact them? And what does that look like in their context? And that's really the first question to clarify so that you can effectively translate those skills for them so they can be the most used. I think that the other thing to take into consideration really is your accessibility, because how you can shape the mental training work that you're doing is going to be highly dependent on how much access you have, whether you have access to athletes, or do you have more access to the coaches? Do you have access to them frequently every day if possible? Do you have access to them once a week or once a month? And how you shape the mental skills work with them really highly depends on that access. And I think, you know, with that, it's important to really think in advance, what are you expecting to be able to accomplish with them in the amount of time and access you have? Mm-hmm. And that can also help inform how do you retell the mental skills? How do you train it? How much opportunity will you have to train it? Or was it going to be primarily psychoeducational and hope that they transition it or they train it? Different questions like that can really help to inform the way to go about the work and shape the work specifically for them in their context with, you know, understanding what's your accessibility, what are their demands, and really what can you expect of those two things?
Mm-hmm. You know, I love how you mentioned understanding the demands of their domain. So if you think about two different sports like golf and basketball, very, very different. One's individual, one's team, one's very open loop, one's very closed loop. When you think of one mental skill that applies to both sports, what are some ways you maybe teach it to two very different sports like, you know, golf or basketball or two other sports of maybe your choice?
Sure. You know, I think that this probably falls in line actually with what my philosophy and approach is in general, is I really like to strive to integrate the mental skills into the practices themselves. And so by default, because of the nature of the practice, that the ways in which we can constrain our practice so that we can see mental skills training or mental skill adaptation is probably like, that's my approach to doing so. So, you know, we can talk in both of the rooms. We can talk in rooms to the golfers and to the basketball players and talk to them about self-talk and how do they refocus when their body language is down, you know, and different things like that. And then to ask them, well, when do you think you might need this? And really allow them to lead that conversation with them as the experts of themselves and their sport. But then you go out to the field or the course and the court, in either of those instances, and you recognize that the ways in which their environment constrains their ability to use that self-talk is really key. So golfers, as an example, I must say, I am not the golf expert. We have an incredible team of mental coaches that work with our golf program here, Dr. Greg Young and Christian Smith. But their self-talk is a lot of downtime, right? Like in between the shots and in between the walking from one hole to the next. And, you know, that environment sets itself up to use mental skills or self-talk as this example really differently than on the basketball court when you just missed your shot and the other team got the rebound and now you have to hustle back to the end of the court. And by the time you get there, hopefully you are using strategies to readjust that self-talk along the way. Mm-hmm. And so to really think about the constraints of the environment and how that might be influencing their ability to use any of those mental skills becomes highly important. And certainly an area of interest of my own personal practice, but really where I think that we can see greater strides in the mental skills training is when we take those contexts and those demands into consideration.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so with you now mentioning the idea of incorporating mental skills into your physical practice, do you think that helps cultivate this culture that's been built at IMG around mental conditioning?
Yeah, I think that, you know, to be able to have a culture of mental conditioning, a sense of normalizing what mental conditioning is. And so when they go and they meet with their skills coach or their head coach or their, you know, in baseball, their pitching coach, you know, to see the mental skills as another coach that's there for you as a resource to improve. I think that that is certainly one of the elements that allows us to kind of normalize and create this culture of mental skills as a part of the process. You know, the other thing that I think is relevant as well is we talk a lot about what mental conditioning is so that people can understand what it is and how they might use it. But I also think it's really important to discuss what mental conditioning is not. And sometimes where we find resistance or where we find difficulty with people either buying in or feeling like they want to pursue it is partly because they think that it's really related to mental health or potentially mental illness, and even to that extent. And so, you know, we have a huge international population here. And so the stigma around mental health, even in the United States, is one area that we have to constantly tend with. And I will be the first to say that mental health is an incredibly important part of the work that's done for anybody, whether it's an athlete or, you know, a youth or a person in general. I think mental health care is of the primary importance. And it's also different from mental performance work. And if we don't really verify what those distinguishing factors are, then we can't expect them to understand the culture of mental conditioning. I mean, I always ensure to tell the athletes that I work with that you don't have to be bad to get better. And it allows them to recognize like, wow, this really is a tool that can help me improve. It's not something that I go to when I need help or I'm not good or something of it. Now, of course, we have those athletes and we work with athletes when it's not good, right? When you miss that shot, when you're in a slump, when you lost the game, you know, when you choked at the last point, whatever it might be. But to really allow them to see that there's so much more opportunity in this work than just that, I think is something that also contributes to normalizing this culture around mental conditioning work.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think you just unpacked so many keys there. And a few that stood out for me was one, the idea of bridging the theory to practice. So showing them like what it looks like and how it can actually be used. Because I feel like when I talk to athletes and I mention the word mindfulness, it's kind of like, whoa, mindfulness. Like when really mindfulness is all about attention, and mindfulness is something that you can bridge into your practice. So I think that's really, really important. And I think the other really, really important thing you mentioned too is that the idea of being proactive with your mental training, and that it you don't have to be in a certain spot. You don't have to be in a bad spot or be performing poorly to do mental training. A lot of the time it's always better to be more proactive, because then if things do start to go bad, you have the tools in place to be able to likely combat them. So you don't get to that point. So I think there's so much you just said there that is so important. And a lot of it just revolves too around stigma breaking.
Yeah, it is. It's really true. And that's certainly a luxury that I recognize that we have here at the Academy, because we are integrated in with the sports and we see these athletes at minimum once a week on a regular basis over the course of the 10 months. And, you know, to be able to be proactive in that element and also to build on and train and not simply put out fires over the course of the season, although we do a lot of that as well. But, you know, I think that is an instrumental part in being able to train the work and really allow this skill to infuse their life, as opposed to be something that they go to when something else isn't working. And, you know, certainly in different environments, you don't always have that luxury, or under different circumstances where, you know, if you don't perform on one day, like your contract gets cut, you know, like the demands, even as mental performance practitioners, is really different with how you might go about the work. And there's certainly a luxury knowing that I'm going to be with this group that we can try different things and we can take time to unpack some of those difficulties and take the time to improve, as well as stay proactive in that space as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so earlier you mentioned that part of your job is working with athletes, but the other part is actually working with corporations. What are some overlaps you see there with the mental skills, you know, training that you talk about and preach? Like, what are some maybe really key points that transfer across both domains?
Oh, I think there are so many more similarities than there are differences in a lot of ways, to a certain extent. Of course, like I said, like in many ways, we're using a lot of the same skills. The performance is still on the line. Just it's instead of goals or buckets, it's money. And, you know, it's salaries and it's people's livelihoods to a degree. And so, you know, I think then there's also the interpersonal interactions that you see on teams on the field versus teams in the boardroom. And what does that look like? And being able to leverage everybody's skills and, you know, creating a plan and then executing it on presentation day instead of game day, and, you know, managing the pressures to perform in that moment, managing the pressures you might have from your bosses or supervisors and so forth. So I do really think that there are a lot of similarities, most certainly, that we see between the athletics environment as well as corporate. And of course, there's differences as well, particularly in the space that I'm in, where I have youth on one side and then I have adults on the other. And, you know, just the different training that comes with that demographic difference in and of itself as well. So I really do feel like there are a lot of similarities, but again, you can only communicate those similarities and that transfer of skill as well as you know their demands and the context in which they're in. And again, in the same realm, I'd say that is of essential importance.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So given the two different age groups then, do you find it's usually easier to teach youth mental skills or adults? I would imagine it'd be easier to teach youth, just because adults, you know, they're older, they've done things for a certain way for a long time. Or what's your perspective on that?
You know, I don't know that necessarily one is easier than the other. I think that you go about the work really differently. You know, certainly I would say that even while kids are really moldable at their developmental stage, they still have a way that they see the world, whether that comes from their parents or whether that comes from their own experiences. So, you know, it's not that we have a completely clean slate. It's just that our slate isn't as driven into the ground just yet. Yeah. So you have a little bit of working opportunity there. I think that it really depends on the age group of the youth, because you work with a 12-year-old boy versus an 18-year-old boy versus a 15-year-old girl. They're at their own different stages of development, specifically with regard to some of these mental skills, like how confidence changes over that youth and in that time of real vulnerability in a lot of ways. You know, and then we look at the adults, and what I do enjoy a lot about working with the adults is they have had a variety of experiences to draw from. Whereas oftentimes I find with the youth, we're sort of creating and crafting these experiences that they may or may not have had yet. So most kids have experienced pressure, but not every kid has failed yet, or at least they don't characterize it as failure. Most kids really want to work hard and get through the grind, but a lot of kids still feel like sport's really fun. And so there's an element of not making an assumption that they have had an experience that you can tack on to in order to really build and I guess, evolve the mental skills. Whereas with the adults, in many cases, they had a lot of life experiences, right? And so then we're able to have a discussion, and they're maybe more comfortable having a discussion around how this impacted them, you know, in their social setting, than that we can then apply the mental skills into. So I don't know that one's necessarily easier than another. I certainly like the difference, and I like the challenge of having to adjust the approach as well as the development of the mental skills, but both are really fun to work with.
Mm-hmm. Love that. So one thing that I really, really enjoy about speaking to different practitioners in our field is that everyone seems to have their own favorite mental skill to teach, whether it be mindfulness or optimism or goal setting, whichever it is. For you, what is your favorite mental skill to teach, and what is your go-to strategy for teaching it?
Great question. And also a challenging one. So if I think about my favorite things to teach, I'm a little biased because probably one of the things that I have taught the most would be the attribute of confidence and how do we develop confidence. You know, I've had the privilege of being in the soccer program here at the Academy for, the last 6 years. And that has challenged me to build confidence in a lot of different ways. So that's probably my go-to, because I've had so much like fun trying to recraft what confidence is and how to communicate it and how do we build it and how do we grow it. Now, of course, there's a variety of skills that come into confidence, right? We can talk self-talk, we can talk visualization, we can talk, you know, perspective shifting and taking action and different things like that. But one of my most favorite ways to start the conversation around confidence, at least so far with some of the teams here at the Academy, has been to ask the question, true or false, confidence is an emotion. And then you have them stand up, you go on one side, yes, confidence is an emotion. And then the other side, they stand and they say, no, confidence is not. And then you allow them to share why they picked where they were. And it really helps to, in your words, unpack what their experience is with confidence and what they believe that they can do with confidence. So, you know, you have some people that are like, yeah, confidence is emotion. I feel it. I feel confident, or I don't feel confident. So it's an emotion, like I feel that. And then the other people are like, no, it's not an emotion, because it's not happy or sad. Like, it's just this belief that you have. And then, you know, okay, well, now what do we do with that, right? And we let them kind of have that conversation to where we can then start talking about how you take action on your confidence, how you might manage some of the emotions that come with confidence, and what do you do in those moments. And I have really enjoyed that exercise to allow them to sort of lay out where they are with their confidence that really paints a picture of where we can go with it. And so by that point, what skills we might use to train it.
Mm-hmm. For sure. One thing that I always like to talk about when the conversation around confidence comes about is the idea that so many of us feel as if we have to feel confident before we do something, right? Oh, I have to feel mm-hmm. confident to take action. I have to feel confident before I do this. But we get caught in this cycle of, oh, well, you know, if you feel like you have to feel confident before you do something, but the number one way confidence is built is by taking action and having past performance accomplishments, then you're likely never going to take action. And if you do, you're not going to be doing it fearlessly. You're going to be worried about fear of failure and judgment. So what are some ways that you think athletes could get past their comfort zone and take that first step out to build their confidence?
This is fascinating because I've been having these conversations really over the course of the last few weeks in terms of how I'm going to be bringing confidence to my teams this year. Because I think oftentimes we think of confidence really in the realm of preparation. Like when I step into this moment, do I believe that I can do this? Do I believe that I can do this skill? Do I believe that I can make this shot? Can I play in this game? What have you? And so that's one angle of confidence. But there's also having confidence in your ability to respond in difficult situations, right? There's having confidence to be able to, as you mentioned, take action even though I might not feel this certain way. So one of the ways that I'm going to try to approach this conversation around confidence with some of my teams this upcoming season is more actually in the terminology of brave. Can I be brave? Because a lot of times when some of the areas in which I really lean confidence is being able to take action even though you might be feeling uncertain, right? Taking a lot of guidance from Dr. Russ Harris's confidence gap work and the ACT approach, right? So really leaning into the fact that, ooh, I feel uncertain about this. Can I still do what I want to do? And so one of the programs that I work with in their philosophy of the psychological principles that are relevant to the positions in various ages, they feel like being brave is really important, which I would agree. So I'm actually going to try to restory confidence in this idea of being brave. And in doing so, it really creates space for the uncertainty. It creates space for the uncomfortable emotions and creates space for us to be brave and confident even in that incongruous space and feeling and so forth. So, you know, of course, one of the things that most people know about me if we work together is I can't help myself with an acronym. So I have like BRAVE as an acronym that really helps us outline all of the skills that we'll be going over for the course of the year, but really using again BRAVE to characterize this idea that we can be confident in uncertainty.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And I'm not sure if there's something in the water at IMG, but David DeSilva actually recommended me the confidence gap. And that's exactly what I was drawing that example from you just said. So as you can see, ton of sticky notes. I like to take notes. So, yeah. I love your perspective, Lindsay. So again, thank you so much for taking the time today, Lindsay. I really, really do appreciate it. It's been a pleasure to talk to you and to reconnect with you and really just see where everything's at with IMG. There's been some chatter with IMG lately. Just they had that big student roundtable. I think there was 178 viewers on it. And I unfortunately did not get to attend, as I mentioned earlier, but I'm really, really appreciative again of you taking the time today, and I'm happy to hear that you're well.
Thank you. No, thank you so much for having me. And, you know, it's a privilege to be able to represent the mental conditioning team here at IMG Academy. We have a team of incredible practitioners. Those who are here with us now and who have been before, like David DeSilva himself, is a true practitioner in the field to follow in his steps. So it was a pleasure to speak with you today. And I just thank you so much for the conversation.
So I regret to inform you that that is all for episode 39 of the Mental Dive podcast. As always, I really, really do appreciate everybody taking the time to listen to my podcast. So thank you so, so much. If you're interested in checking me out a little more, find me on social, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, at Taylor Staden. TayLorSTaden. Have a fantastic rest of your weekend, everybody, and I'm looking forward to sharing another episode with you soon. Until next time.